And that's what I'll live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. It just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions.
I wanted to show you these sentences here.
But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it for money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh. It
lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I might. There will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview. So we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic. And you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Ata, the host of this program. We've been in the studio for today's discussion. I have a very special guest speaker, Brother Suhail. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam. I would like to thank all the listeners to be part of this session, inshallah.
Inshallah. That's all right. For today's discussion, we want to talk about a sect which is called nowadays as Wahhabis or Wahhabism. Some people say that this sect, we can say, did not exist in among the Islamic sects or especially the Sunni ones. And the Shias has created this terminology in order to refer to, for example, to special behaviors of some Muslims. Historically speaking, what do we have about Wahhabism, Sheikh?
I would like to start from historical roots
yes.
of Wahhabism. If we go back to our history and look up its painful events, some of those events shall attract our attention to reveal to us that Wahhabism, which we have known in this century, had ancient roots since the very beginning of Islam.
Okay.
They were apparent at one time, hidden at the other, doing taqiyya, which they do deny right now. One time they appeared daringly, and the other time they hid because of fear and dissimulation, what we call taqiyya.
Yes.
Until the time that Islam had regressed and its pillars and great personalities were afflicted,
yes.
Then colonialism came to feed and strengthen this new thought.
Yes,
The aim behind it was to destroy the sanctity of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Muslim, due to colonialist thoughts, sanctified two things: the Quran and the Sunnah. These are two basic sources of the Islamic Sharia that was targeted by them. They know that the speech of Allah can never be changed and distorted, because Allah Almighty has undertaken its preservation.
Yes.
But as for the Prophet's Sunnah, it is liable to distortion and fabrication. In fact, since the first day the Prophet left this world, disagreement took place amongst Muslims on the Prophet's Sunnah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
However, the colonists perceived that the scholars of the time of the nation had set right for the Sunnah and collected its true and reliable traditions and put laws and rules to keep it safe from increase or decrease. Therefore, they thought of a satanic trick that might help them do away with the spiritual matters that the most active factor in this life of Muslim. It was that whatever Muslims gave up on these spiritualities, they would approach them step by step with unfaithful materialism,
okay,
and then they would become like the scum of Lot.
That's
over
right.
Here, we would like to talk some of the events that took place after the prophets,
yes,
and during his last period while he was in okay. this world. And we have this hadith of Qartas.
Yes.
You see, where they come and say that one of the brothers at that time would come and tell the prophet that the prophet had asked for paper and pen, and this brother would come, or this companion would come and say that, na'udhu billah, you have gone like into this, you are not thinking properly.
Yes.
And therefore, Quran is enough for us.
Uh-huh.
You see, taking only one part of it, because when you say that you follow Quran and Sunnah, means everything that the Prophet said. So Qirtas is actually the Sunnah of the Prophet. By neglecting it, you are thinking about something else. And the second incident was, again, after the Prophet has passed away, a companion came ahead and said that for those of you who believe in Muhammad, Muhammad is dead.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of you who believe in Allah, he is alive and will continue.
Okay.
For this kind of statement to be made, it is such a kind of nonsense, because anyone who says that if you believe in Muhammad, nobody believed Muhammad was Allah.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone believed Allah was Allah.
Yes.
And everyone knew that Allah would continue in the religion.
So sorry, do they have any specific fiqhiyya school of thought, the Wahhabis, I mean? For example, are they Hanbali, Shafi'i, or something like that?
Yeah, so here what we know is that regarding to... there was this... It was... I would talk about
yes.
something that would clarify this.
Okay.
Here we would like to say that it was Wahhabism in its prettiest clothes...
Mm-hmm.
Clothes and clearest tongues. It plotted yesterday and is trying now to execute the plot for today and tomorrow. Here I would like to talk where the Muslims are accepted as sects,
okay.
which will go back to Egypt,
okay.
Al-Azhar University,
yes. okay.
where a lot of Muslims take their sect for ideologies and fiqh matters from that school.
Okay.
Historically, Al-Azhar had a membership that represented diverse opinions within Islam's. The theological schools of Al-Ash'ari and Maturidi
yes.
were both represented, and it has long tradition of teaching all four schools of Islamic thought,
okay.
which is the schools of Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi, and Hanbali.
Yes.
In 2016, Ahmad Al-Tayyib reissued the fatwa on Shia Muslim, calling them the fifth Shia
yes.
school of Islam,
okay.
and seeing no problem with the conversion from Sunni to Shia Islam. Now, the term Wahhabism... was not used by Abdullah ibn al-Wahhab
yes.
himself.
Yes.
They used to call themselves as Salafi or the Muwahidun.
Yes.
You see?
Okay.
But as we see, we normally have these names. For example, we have over here Al-Ash'ari, Maturidi. Al-Ash'ari is Asha'ir, the
yes,
people
yes.
who follow him. The Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi, and Hanafi are also schools
Hanbali.
Of thought that, yeah, yes. Hanbali, that take from these scholars that were
yes.
over here. You see, they call themselves Salafis, they like to be called. But because they were following the ideologies of Abdullah ibn al-Wahhab, that's when this Wahhabi came to existence.
That's right. Muhammad ibn Abdul-Wahhab.
Yeah, Muhammad ibn Abdul-Wahhab.
Yes, yes.
Yes, right. In theology, Wahhabism is closely aligned with the Athari.
Mm.
Athari means traditionalists.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay,
school which represents prevalent theological position of the Hanbali legal school.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So if you see at this point, yes, they are part of sect, but not as itself. They stay behind Hanbali school in this progress. As a school in theology, no, because the Azhar accepts the Al-Ash'ari and Maturidi
yes.
as the school of thought, not Athari.
Yes.
We have Ash'ari and Athari.
Okay.
Athari theology is characterized by reliance on Zahir, like the apparent or literal meaning of the Holy Quran and Hadith, and opposition to rational arguments in the matters of Aqidah favored by Asharites and Maturid. Over here, I would like to say that right now in Al-Azhar, Wahhabi is not a part of sect.
Yes.
It's a dimension of a Hanbali sect that use, but they are still different from Hanbalis themselves.
Is it true that Ibn Taymiyyah thought had direct effect on the Wahhabis?
So, yeah, the roots also do come from there as well.
Okay.
Yeah, so yes, they have certain followers, but because in that time it was not that heavily approached compared to the time of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. That's why that went down door and the Wahhabism spread from there because of these roots that they had at the end. As I said, that these roots had begin from the beginning of Islam towards the end, but it gained its strength in the end towards Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab with the support that he was getting from the West.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
There are some opinions, I mean, Islamic beliefs related to Wahhabis. For example, giving visitation to the graves is forbidden. Building out the buildings or domes or something like that on the graves is forbidden. Just going to do tawassul to them is a kind of shirk. You know, how can I say? That's all right. You cannot swear by the names of other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Tawassul again is forbidden. Having celebrations for the birthday anniversaries of the infallible Imams or, for example, Prophet Muhammad is forbidden. Tabarruk is forbidden. And all these, you know, according to their thoughts, are forbidden. Are they really rooted in Islam? I mean, we did not have such traditions in Islam to do so. Prophet Muhammad himself used to give, for example, visitation to the holy tombs of Hamza, Sayyid al-Shuhada, and we can say the martyrs of Uhud, even crying over the graves, doing salutations for them, doing supplications for them. So where do these ideas come from?
So we have the same issues regarding this, and one of the issues, apart from the ones that you mentioned, is that according to them, God has parts and limitations.
Uh-huh.
He has a body.
Okay.
You see?
Oh, and this is what they believe?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, why do we call Wahhabis a diverted path? Is because they believe on the essence, on the literal meaning of Quran. For example, we have Yadullah in the verses of Quran. Okay. We have some verses that literally means face of Allah, hand of Allah. In some of the traditions, we have that na'udhu billah, Allah will show his feet on the day of judgment and he will put on fire. Mm-hmm. Where some of them have said that what kind of hell it is, where the Lord of Muslims first will be going to hell and like make sure the hell is filled. You see, these kind of ideologies are there in their sect. Regarding tawassul and these things, what you said is true. They have this belief because they take everything literally. So, for example, regarding tawassul, they will bring some verses regarding the Holy Quran that says that only Allah should be believed and no one else. You see? But yes, at the same time, they would delay out the verses that says Allah does ask his believers to use wasila. You see, the difference between Muslims and Wahhabis in general is this, because we have a lot of Sunnis that actually do visit graves, do ask for the shifa of the Holy Prophet. It's only Wahhabis in the sense that don't.
Yeah. That's all right.
This is there.
Okay. So can we see, for example, any similarities between the Wahhabis and the Kharijites or Khawarij? Could we see that, historically speaking?
The Khawarij are somewhat different than Wahhabis. They might have similarities,
okay,
but not as such, because they believe in the concept, the whole basis of Kharijites is the concept of Kufr and Iman.
Yes.
Where Kufr and Iman, according to them, if anyone does greater sins, any of the greater sins, he is neither Mu'min or Kafir.
Okay.
He is somewhere between. You see, while the Wahhabis do not wait for Gunahani Kabire or the greater sins.
Greater sins, that's right.
What they do is, for example, right now, if you see anyone that does not follow their ideology according to their own books, is a kafir.
That's right.
So either you are a muwahidun or kafir. There is nothing like Sunni or Shia according to them. However, they use the basis of Sunni to propagate Islam according to their ideologies.
That's right. There are so many books written on criticizing the Wahhabis' viewpoints. Some of the most important ones are Minhaj al-Irshad, Liman Irad al-Sadat by Sheikh Jafar Kashif al-Ghita, Wahhabism by written by Ayatollah Jafar Subhani, Musuat al-Naqdiya by Wahhabiya. You know, again, this has been a Musua, a collection of the books written on criticizing the Wahhabism. Written by Ahl Sunnah themselves, because these ideas are even criticized by Wahhabism and so many other outstanding books. Kashf al-Irtiyab, fi Atba' Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, Muhsin Amin al-Amali, the outstanding Shiite scholar, has written also this book in criticism of Wahhabism. Thank you much, Brother Suhaid.
I would like to advise one more book by Ahmad al-Tijani.
Ahmad Tijani.
The book's name is All Solutions Are With the Progeny of the Holy Prophet.
Holy Prophet, that's right.
Of which it does talk a bit about these issues and where he has a debate with one of the greatest scholars of Wahhabi that came in, and the way he was able to dictify this person, and the followers that came to see the debate, they ended up accepting Tijani.
Yes.
Thanking him, because they were always believing on what they were saying. The discussion was related to the topic of Tawassul.
That's right.
And that's when it got sorted, and a lot of them accepted this truth.
Thank you very much, Brother Suhail, for a nice explanation, giving us fruitful discussion and really outstanding and rich details regarding Wahhabism during the history of Islam. It was very kind of you. Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol. I am at your service to talk about another strategy that helps us enjoy a more appropriate life based on the concepts of the Quran and Islamic narrations. Today I want to talk about giving charity to needy and destitute people. There is a vast discussion about the realm of charity regarding how much we should donate, to whom we should give money, the conditions related to it, for example, the charity is better to be done secretly or publicly, the divine rewards of it, and many other related issues. But for today, I try to only focus on a general concept of charity. Maybe I have another fortune to talk about this subject. Charity in general has both individual and social benefits. It also has a significant positive effect on man's material and spiritual life. In Islam, charity or as-sadaqah only can attract divine reward if it is done with the intention of seeking closeness to Allah, which is called in Arabic terminology al-qastul qurbah. Charity and giving alms in Islam is sometimes obligatory, like zakat and khums, and sometimes recommended, like all kind of donation that is paid in the way of Allah, be it in the form of giving money to a destitute man or a diseased man who needs help, we help him to be cured. And in some cases, it has a general aspect like building hospitals and orphanages and etc. Orphanages and the like. Imam Ali, in one of his noble sayings, interprets charity as a healing medicine and says, As-sadaqatu dawa'un munjih. The word dawa means medicine, and the word munjih means effective and healing. So he says charity is like an effective and healing medicine. As I will describe, this narration says that charity is a cure for both individual and social diseases. And by diseases here, the Imam refers to the problems people have. We have seen in many cases that by donation, many deprived patients are treated, they are cured, orphans are taken care of, and the pains of the poor are soothed. For instance, if a natural disaster like an earthquake or vast fire happens somewhere, humanitarian donations or financial donations is the most useful thing that does the job. This aid is nothing but a vast wealth that is gathered by charity givers. The aid provided by organizations such as the World Red Cross or UNICEF is largely dependent on these people's contributions. Just imagine if every neighbor think about his own neighbor, or the worshippers who go to the mosque to pray are aware of each other's financial and other problems and try to help those who need. If a family thinks about other families or their close relatives, if a friend thinks about the need of his own friends, then such a society is very unlikely to have serious financial problems. For example, today my friend has taken a loan or is in a debt to someone and does not have enough money to settle it and to return the money back, so I try to help him. The next day I may be in financial problem and my friend will help me. This is a real deal that we could have in our normal life in a society. This is what Imam Ali says in one of his noble sayings, and pointed to his saying that introduced charity as Dawa'un Munjih, that he mentioned this narration, which means that charity is like a healing medicine. In a broader view, charity has got a spiritual effect, which means that by charity or as sadaqah, giving sadaqah, God will remove many calamities from man's life. As it is narrated from the Prophet to have said, "Dawu maldakum bisadaqah wa ruddu abwab al-bala'i bid-du'a." Treat your sicks with charity and close the doors of calamity with asking Allah by praying. Experience also has shown that giving charity is very effective for treating patients. Charity giving is so important in Islam that a portion of man's property is obligatory to be extracted and be spent on the expenses that is described in Islamic laws, and this portion is zakat and khums. Even in the Quran, charity is usually mentioned next to the payer. This verse we have heard it a lot, Aqamu Salata wa Atu Zakat. Aqamu Salat means to perform prayer, and next to it is often the sentence wa Atu Zakat, that means those who give alms. Mentioning the prayer next to giving alms means that to the same degree that man should have a relationship with Allah by saying the prayer, he should also maintain his relationship with God's servants through financial aid and giving charity. Let's take a break, and I will be back soon.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
A society where its people are attentive to each other's problem and try to solve them, this society is strong, united, and powerful. In such a society, people's hearts are tied together, kindness prevails, and people enjoy more peace and calmness. As a result, the people of this society can worship God more. They can be obedient more easily because their minds are less involved in worldly problems. More importantly, there is no doubt that such a society will be exposed to the mercy of the merciful God because they are more attentive and more prone to worship Allah because their mind is less entangled with worldly matters. As a result, Allah will have more mercy on the individuals in that society. A significant part of the problems that exist in a society is due to financial problems. If everyone tries to solve this problem in his own turn, a large part of human problems will be solved. If the spirit of charity and humanitarian aid spreads in a society, the price of goods will become cheaper, many worries for the future will disappear, and some of the high prices will be reduced. But if the money remains stagnant, for example, in the form of treasures in one's house, every individual houses, on in people's bank account without being used or, what to say, without being included in the economic cycle of the society, it ends in many forms of social problems. That also it will affect personal life of people, those people who are going to gather more money. Even though they have a lot of money, but eventually they should spend, on the other hand, more money as well. And in such a society, that people are more attentive to gather more and more, the poverty line is getting higher and higher. With this explanation, it becomes more clear why charity is described as a saving and healing medicine in what Imam Ali said in his short sayings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Israeli regime is stepping up its violent and racist policies against Palestinians. On Thursday, a young Palestinian man succumbed to his injuries that he recently sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, also known as Ariha. 22-year-old Mahmoud Jamal Hamdan was critically wounded during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp. On Wednesday, Israeli troops stormed the Aqaba Jab refugee camp following a shooting attack on a highway outside of Jericho that left one Israeli soldier dead. During the raid, the regime's forces sealed off the camp and prevented ambulances and journalists from entering it. They also fatally wounded Hamdan, whom they accused of being involved in the attack. Regime atrocities come against the backdrop of increasing settler violence against Palestinians. On Sunday night, hundreds of armed Israeli settlers, flanked by soldiers, attacked Palestinian villages near the West Bank town of Hawara and set fire to homes, storefronts, and cars.
I was here yesterday when the incident occurred. I didn't know how to escape, as they closed immediately all roads and exits. So I was obliged to stay here. I locked the door, and after that the settlers came to burn things. They set fire to all the wood I had, the car, and they burnt the area.
At least one Palestinian was killed and nearly 400 were wounded in the hours-long rampage, which was denounced by Israeli rights group Peace Now and B'Tselem as a settler pogrom supported by the occupying regime. Palestinian officials have called on the U.S. Security Council to ensure protection for Palestinians who have increasingly come under deadly attacks by Israeli forces and settlers.
What we have seen here in this house is evidence of how big the crime carried out by the settlers and covered by army and protected by the army is. It is clear that this move is supported by a political decision from the Israeli cabinet. Therefore, three sides are partners in this crime. The cabinet, which takes the political decision, the army, which is protecting the settlers, and the settlers who are implementing. This is what we have seen here.
The Arab League has also said that it fully holds the far-right Israeli administration led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responsible for the systematic crimes committed by extremist settlers. After they went on a violent rampage in the West Bank, Israeli forces have killed nearly 70 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. On Tuesday, the Israeli Knesset approved a bill authorizing the execution of Palestinian detainees to conduct anti-occupation operations. Hamas resistance movement has strongly condemned the bill, noting that the move reflects the regime's, quote, fascist tendencies. Hamas has stressed that such policies and laws will not deter the Palestinian people from continuing their legitimate resistance against the Israeli occupation. Furthermore, on Wednesday, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who is an ultra-nationalist in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition, said that the Palestinian village of Huwara should be wiped out.
All over Israel, here in Tel Aviv and elsewhere, we are protesting against the horrific pogrom committed by the extremist settlers in the West Bank yesterday. They came because they have the support of the government. They have the support of high-ranking Kahanist ministers serving in the government, and they are deepening the occupation, deepening the bloodshed.
So we are here tonight to demonstrate after the settlers in Hawara attacked and burned the village and the people who live in Hawara, the Palestinian people. And we are here to demonstrate to stop the occupation.
Even the U.S. administration, which is Tel Aviv's staunch ally, has called the remarks repugnant. Attacks against Palestinians have escalated since late December 2022, when Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power as prime minister of the occupying regime's most far-right cabinet ever. Netanyahu is now under mounting pressure. Streets across the occupied territories have witnessed mass protests since Netanyahu's controversial move to reform the judiciary. Opponents argue that the legal changes threaten the independence of judges and weaken oversight of the ruling cabinet and parliament. They say the plan will undermine the rights of minorities and would open the door to more corruption. But Netanyahu, who is on trial for corruption, says the changes will boost business. There are now threats that his coalition cabinet will break up due to internal differences and mass protests.
A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Instead of supporting dialogue and a peaceful resolution, the West, particularly the US, have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine. This trend has only further escalated the conflict. Last week, Beijing called for a comprehensive ceasefire as it released a peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. The document, which covers 12 aspects, adheres to the principle of respecting the sovereignty of both countries. It calls for resuming peace talks and promotes the post-conflict reconstruction in the long run. Beijing also demanded an end to unilateral sanctions on Russia and criticized NATO expansion, saying the US and NATO are fanning the flames and adding fuel to the fire, and they are the culprit and pusher of the crisis. China also made clear its opposition to not only the use of nuclear weapons, but the threat of deploying them, saying nuclear weapons must not be used and nuclear wars must not be fought. In addition, China also called for efforts to set up humanitarian corridors for the evacuation of civilians from conflict zones, to protect civilians and prisoners of war, and to facilitate grain exports. China has sought to position itself as a neutral party in the conflict and play the role of a mediator. Meanwhile, Russia said it has paid a lot of attention to the plan by China, but the conditions for a peaceful resolution of the conflict were not in place. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "For now, we don't see any of the conditions that are needed to bring this whole story towards peace." Moscow had said that any settlement of the conflict needed to recognize Russia's control over four Ukrainian regions it annexed last year. It also wants Ukraine to renounce its bid to join NATO. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country needed to work with China, arguing it seems that there is a respect for Ukraine's territorial integrity and security issues in the Chinese perspective. However, Kyiv said that it will not agree to any peace without the return of all its territory. The publication of the proposal follows accusations from the West that China is considering arming Russia, a claim Beijing has dismissed as false information. Ukraine's head of military intelligence has brushed aside claims that China is considering sending arms to Russia. Kirill Budanov told US media that he saw no signs that such things are even being discussed. That's after senior US officials said that they were confident China was considering providing lethal equipment to Moscow. Earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken aired Washington's concerns about potential arms shipments in a tense meeting with his Chinese counterpart. Also, the director of the CIA, William Burns, said in an interview on Sunday that he believed Beijing was still weighing the possibility. Asked specifically about the U.S. assessment, Budenov said, "I am the head of intelligence and I rely, with all due respect, not on the opinions of individual people, but only on facts. I do not see such facts." China says it has kept contact with all sides in the crisis, including Kyiv, and its position was clear. The core is to call for peace and promote dialogue and promote a political solution to the crisis. China has warned that the war in Ukraine is getting out of control. Beijing has urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire, saying it's deeply concerned about the situation. Beijing rejected the U.S. and NATO claims as false and said it is the U.S. that is endlessly sending arms to Ukraine, not China. The U.S. and NATO have been warning China against sending weapons to Russia, while they have been providing Ukraine with billions of dollars in arms and military aid since the beginning of the war a year ago.
The U.S. desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of the special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally. Visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge a global arrogance. In the words of Pandor herself, "The current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order." Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pandor argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the U.S., the U.K., and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seemed to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West's imperialism. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has announced the operation of a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. Speaking at a televised program, commander of the IRGC Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amirali Hajizadeh, said the new long-range missile is codenamed Pave. The commander said this was to honor the Iranian forces martyred in the Kurdistan province. The Brigadier General noted that all of Iran's missiles are now manufactured with precision-guided accuracy, adding that all American bases in the region are within the reach of the Iranian missiles. Hajizadeh said, "We are now capable of targeting American aircraft carriers at a 2,000-kilometer distance." He noted that the U.S.'s superiority has been shaking after Iran developed its new hypersonic missile, which can maneuver outside the Earth's atmosphere and defeat all anti-missile defense systems. In a stern warning also to Europe, the Iranian commander said, "Of course, we have kept the distance at 2,000 kilometers out of respect for the Europeans," adding, "We hope that Europeans would preserve their dignity." The remarks by the Iranian commander came at a time when Europe has done its share of trying to antagonize Iran by closely aligning its Tehran policies with those of the U.S. After all, the European countries, namely France, Germany, and the UK, have been maintaining a hostile posture toward Iran's defensive missile and peaceful nuclear programs. The EU has also challenged Tehran's regional influence and cooperated with Washington in its anti-Iran sanctions. Needless to say that last month, the European Parliament approved an amendment calling on the European Union and its member states to include the IRGC on their terror list. The resolution drew strong reaction from Iran. IRGC's chief commander, Major General Hossein Salami, warned that the Europeans would suffer the consequences of the move. The 27-nation bloc has also been slapping more sanctions on Iran over what it calls the country's approach toward foreign-backed riots that erupted in some Iranian cities in September. The recent IRGC announcement comes as the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on the country's military to increase its efforts to attract, nurture, and train capable Iranians in line with the Islamic Revolution military doctrine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on the IRGC to use its full capabilities to be able to protect the revolution and to strengthen the IRGC's spiritual and military foundations. This can be clearly highlighted in General Hajizadeh's comments when he addressed the issue of Iran's growing missile power. He has enumerated features of the country's hypersonic missile that was manufactured late last year and announced a new cruise missile's inclusion in the list of IRGC's military hardware. This brings to the spotlight the military might of the Islamic Republic, which includes capabilities of Iran's army with its latest underground base for fighter jets and more particularly the country's missile power in the face of the West's threats. That comprises threats coming from Israel, with the regime targeting several military sites in the city of Isfahan lately. While U.S.'s benefit lies in creating regional insecurity, as General Hajizadeh put it, there needs to be a military power in the region to deter such threats. Tehran believes that Washington is a root cause of almost all global conflicts, including the war in Ukraine. The Islamic Republic argues that the West Asia region sits on a security fault line, given the history of conflicts in the past four decades. Another factor that Tehran has always highlighted is the need to maintain the country's military might. It says if it fails to be strong, the enemy will bring the war inside Iran. That's why Iranian military commanders urge and advise Iranian armed forces to meet the security needs of the nation. Given all the threats posed by the U.S. and its allies, the Corps has always been aiming to render the American war machine ineffective and thus has managed to bring all the U.S.'s regional bases within the range of its defensive firepower. They have also turned Washington bases in the region into its weak spots, with the IRGC having the ability to strike U.S. outposts whenever the need arises.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to the Youth Station. I'm your host, Zainab Askari, and today I have had the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, Sister Zainab?
Alhamdulillah, I'm fine. How are you, brother?
Alhamdulillah, not bad. Our topic is interesting. The birth anniversary of Ali Akbar, the son of Imam Hussein.
It is indeed. So before we get into the topic, I am staying with you for the first time, Brother Muhammad.
Yeah, I'm Muhammad, as you know.
Yeah.
And I'm from South America, and I study in the Hausa at the moment. And yeah, it's basically the summary of my life, essentially, yeah.
So when did you actually come to Hausa?
It's been around 6 years now.
All right.
I've been in Iran for 6 years at least now, and it's been a great experience so far. Yeah.
Nice. So, well, I'm Zainab Askari, and I come from Kashmir.
Great.
Which is administrated, and...
unfortunately, should I say. Or yeah. Fortunately.
No, we also consider that unfortunate. And I have also been in Hausa for some 8 years now. Actually, I have been in Iran for some 8 years. First of all, I actually congratulate you on the very auspicious occasion.
Thank you very much. Congratulations to you and all the listeners.
Yeah, thank you.
On the occasion of the birth anniversary of Ali Akbar, the son of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Known as the Youth Day over here.
Yeah, that's...
And that's what I got to know for the first time when I was in Hausa, and all these ladies around in the administration, they gathered us in the prayer room, and they told us we have something special for you. And they were beautiful red roses, fresh. And they called us one by one, and they started giving us the red roses. And I was amazed to see that.
I have never seen
that before in my life. Like a woman giving roses to women and then congratulating on some special
thing. Exactly.
Day.
A while ago, we had an episode, I think, with Brother Muzaffar, and he was talking about the environment and how culture affects a person. I think this is one of the great benefits of being in an Islamic country. Then the culture around you, for example, the Women's Day is going to be the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima. Father's Day is going to be the birth anniversary of Imam Ali. The Youth Day is going to be the birth anniversary of Ali Akbar. And these occasions, and when they're kind of combined with the kind of the things that we have today, like Youth Day and Women's Day and so on, it gives you a very good culture of, you know, an Islamic culture. It gives you a good, great feeling.
Like I had been all my life celebrating the Women's Day, rather anchoring on the program for the programs of Women's Day. On 8th of March, which is considered to be the International Women's Day.
Yeah.
But then when I got to know that Women's Day in Iran is different, and I couldn't deny that. But in India...
It gives some spirit into it, right? Because having an 8th of... What is it, an 8th of
like
March? There's nothing
the
special
The thing that
in
was
it.
Into my head that time was, what else could be the better day than this
Exactly,
day?
Exactly. So yeah, these are the benefits of being in an Islamic country. You have a very great culture. Let's talk about some of the characteristics of Ali Akbar, this great... personality. I think what we must shed light on is the role models youth choose to be today, especially in
That's
the modern
the
world.
That's the most important topic we can talk on.
Yeah, yeah. So in the modern world, you see people, especially youths, they end up choosing role models, whether it be in reality or fantasies, but they're not necessarily role models that are going to give them success. People like, you know...
What are the criteria, as per you, that the youth today goes and chooses a role model?
To me, I think, first of all, how I would personally perceive this is taking that criteria, as the Quran says, Uswatun Hasana. The Prophet is your Uswa Hasana, the best role model,
yeah.
Right? I'll take that as the main criteria, and I'll see who is the most closest to the Prophet in my day and age. To see, and I'll make that person as my role model, right? I'll find all the characteristics of the person who is closest to the Prophet, and I'll make that person as a role model. But then the youth today, that's not how, unfortunately, many of them see it.
Well, I know that this criteria has definitely come into your mind.
Yeah.